Emanuela Orlandi, a vibrant young soul with a passion for music, vanished without a trace from the heart of Vatican City 4 decades ago. June 22, 1983, marked the ominous day when she left for a routine music lesson, never to return home. Pietro Orlandi, her devoted brother, recounts the agony of those initial moments of panic and desperation as their search for Emanuela was met with dismissiveness from authorities. The Vatican's tepid response and lack of cooperation compounded the family's anguish, sparking suspicions of a sinister cover-up. Amidst the chaos, cryptic phone calls from purported kidnappers injected fear into the Orlandi family, further clouding the mystery surrounding Emanuela's fate. As the years passed, Pietro's unwavering resolve to uncover the truth intensified, fueled by chilling theories of Vatican complicity and clandestine dealings with the mafia. The recent reopening of the case in 2023 reignited hope, yet Pietro remains ensnared in a labyrinth of deceit and betrayal, grappling with the haunting shadows of his sister's disappearance that refused to fade.
Gold Shields brings true stories from law enforcement, the military, true crime authors, and first responders. Experience the dedication, danger, and emotional toll with the heroes themselves. These gripping tales of true crimes, true stories, and true heroes are all here on Gold Shields.
This is Dan Murphy back with Gold Shields along with my partner in crime, Tom Smith. How are you today, buddy?
I'm really excited, Danny. Very excited about this show.
Yeah, we've been looking forward to this for quite some time, and it's been a time in the making. This is a globally known case, and we are blessed today to have gentleman Pietro Orlandi with us from Italy, and we're going to be asking him some questions, and he's going to be doing some explaining about his sister, Emanuela Orlandi, who went missing almost 41 years ago in Vatican City. This is a case that has been widely known through the Netflix documentary, The Vatican Girl, and we have that missing girl's brother, Pietro, on with us today, and we're very, very fortunate. And we also want to thank in advance Maria Dolgetta, who is our expert translator, who is helping us out today. So you'll hear her voice as well. Good evening to you. Good morning to us. And thank you, Pietro, for joining us today. So your family lived in Vatican City for a long time. Is that the only place you remember living at that point?
Sì.
He said his grandfather was born in the Vatican in 1920, and he was the caretaker of the horses and the carriages and all that that had to do with the transportation in Vatican City at the time. And his father was born in-house in Vatican City as well, because there were no hospitals or clinics or anything.
Wow. So let's get into his family. Tell us a little bit about your family, the makeup of your family, your sisters, and of course, Emanuela.
Dunque, noi abbiamo passato un'infanzia bellissima. Siamo stati sicuramente dei bambini fortunati perché.
He says he had a wonderful, beautiful childhood, probably better than any other child, because they grew up in this magical place, which was Vatican City, and they had these gardens where they could spend all their time, and it was just really a great childhood. So he felt like he lived in a bubble. He felt like they were constantly protected by, you know, anyone who lived in Vatican City, by the Pope, by the Cardinals. So he said whenever he would leave the gates, he felt almost anxious and he couldn't wait to return because they lived in this protective little bubble, and it was wonderful. He said that in a way they were very naive because they grew up in this protective little bubble. And when what happened to Emanuela happened, it was just a complete nightmare because they never thought anything could happen to them. They thought they were protected and in this safe place. And so they just couldn't believe that they found themselves in this just complete nightmare.
Tell us about your sister, Emanuela.
Io avevo con Emanuela un rapporto molto forte, eravamo molto legati.
So he said he had a really, really strong relationship with her. They were very, very close. He said she was extremely passionate about music, about classical music. She played the piano, the flute, she sang in the chorus, and she was always interested in, you know, he at the time was listening to bands like Led Zeppelin, and so she always was interested in what music he was listening to. And he was the only brother with four sisters, so he and Manuela really had a very strong bond. And he said it's interesting because a lot of times when you talk about somebody who's not around anymore, people kind of exaggerate or elaborate the person that they were. And he said she was just a very normal young girl. He said she was a normal young girl and she liked to do the same things that all the other young girls her age liked to do. But music was definitely her passion and they had a very, very strong relationship.
So we're going to go to June 22nd, 1983, and that morning. Let's walk through that morning. What, you know, her leaving the house, what the morning was like. I understand it was a very hot day. But take us through that morning of the last time he actually saw Emanuela.
Allora, era una giornata caldissima.
So it was a very, very hot morning. He remembers it as if, you know, as a film. He says, I can see all the pieces in front of me as if I'm watching a film. And Emanuela was home with her sisters and her brother. The parents were out at an uncle's house. And she asked him to take her to music lessons because it was a very hot day and there may have been a strike of some sort with the transportation system. And Pietro was not going to take her because he was meeting with his girlfriend instead. And she got very upset. And she kind of flipped her hair back and walked out the door and slammed the door. But he never thought that that would be the last time that he would see her.
And at what time, it was later on that night, does he remember that the family started realizing something was wrong?
So that evening around 7 o'clock, Emanuela called home and she spoke to her sister Federica, who was the only one that was at home. And she said, oh, well, I just want to tell you that before I went into my music lessons, this man approached me from this company Avon. And he said that if I wanted to, I could be, you know, representative for them and I would make a good amount of money, about 250,000 lira, which at the time was a good amount of money, more than you would expect from that kind of job for a young girl, especially. And so she was speaking to her sister and her sister said, well, you know, our parents are not home right now. I think it's a good idea if you let them know, give them the information before you go ahead and take this job. And she said, well, this man was going to be waiting for me outside of my lessons. This was after her lesson, but she was still inside the school calling from there. And he's going to give me some information, some paperwork to bring home so that our parents could look at it. And then she was supposed to meet with her younger sister, Cristina, right near the school. And she never showed up.
So at a point in time later on that night, when Emanuela does not come home, what do you do? Do you start your search for Emanuela throughout Vatican City and outside the walls?
Guarda, mio padre è una persona molto rigida, vuole alle 8:30 di sera.
So he said that his dad was very strict. So by 8:30, everyone had to be home at the dinner table all together. So they kind of at that point knew right away when his sister Cristina came home without Emanuela that something was wrong, and the tension was felt immediately. 8:39 o'clock, they all could feel that there was something that was not right. So they panicked a bit. They started calling around her friends. Obviously, no cell phones at the time, so it wasn't easy to get in touch with people at that point. But they would have thought that she would have at least called home if she was going to be late. They thought immediately to this random man that had approached her after school, and that obviously didn't sit easy with them. So after calling around to friends, they decided to go out and start searching for her themselves. First, they started with the school, obviously, which was the last place that she had been seen. He was on his motorcycle and his father was in the car, and they kind of just went around to different parks in the area. And he said he did things he never thought he would have to do, like to search behind, you know, big trash bins in parks late at night looking for his sister's body, because at that point they just thought she had been taken and possibly molested or raped and left somewhere to die.
So the initial report to the police was not taken per se. They didn't take it because it was too soon, right? They're so used to young people just running away and coming home later.
It was mentioned that yes, they went to the police and the police said just keep looking. They tried to make a police report, but they said it was too early at that time. So they didn't let them make a police report, and police did not follow through. So there really was no attention brought to the case until the Pope made an announcement on the 3rd of July. And he was really the first one to speak at all about, you know, a kidnapping or people who were involved. Before that, it was just she had disappeared. But there was a time about 3 days after she disappeared that the men from the Italian Secret Service, which they call La Siste, did show up at his house asking about Emanuela and inquiring about her. And they thought it was very strange because at the time it was only that she had disappeared and the police didn't want to be involved. Why were the Italian Secret Service all of a sudden interested in it? But it really didn't get any type of attention other than that until the Pope came out and made his announcement about it. And the Pope doesn't come and address the public without anything that is pre-written. So Pietro was able to go ahead and see what he had prepared to say. And he was the first one, the Pope, really, to talk about the fact that it was a kidnapping, that she was taken and not just missing, and that there were players involved, there were people involved.
So at what point now do the police actively get involved in the case, or does it? You know, after the Pope now mentions her name and mentions the case on July 3rd, does that spark the Vatican and the police to get more involved?
Allora.
So he said after the Pope made his announcement, the Vatican police never wanted anything to do with the case. They said that they had no inquiries, that they never conducted any inquiries, any investigations. They said she was taken on Italian soil, so that it was not up to them to get involved or to find out what had happened to her, even though she was a citizen of the Vatican. Which, you know, was always a little suspicious to begin with. And then after the Pope made his announcement, a few days later is when they received the first official phone call from the so-called kidnapper. And at that point was when everyone, aside from the Vatican police, started getting involved. The civil secret service, the military police, the Roman police, the Italian police. So it was kind of like the family was put aside, and now they had sort of taken over because there was this extra piece to the puzzle that had finally been taken a bit more seriously.
So the person who called, is that the same gentleman that was featured on Netflix as having admitted that he was involved in this, saying he was involved in this?
Yeah. So the first official phone call that they knew of was the 5th of July, a few days after the Pope had made his official announcement about Emanuela. And the name Americano came from his uncle, who answered the phone and said that he had a foreign accent, and he said could be like an American, but they're not really sure, you know, if it was an American or not. And they were acting on behalf of somebody, so they're not, you know, they don't believe that that was the actual kidnapper or the presumed kidnapper, but that he was acting, you know, on behalf of somebody else or a group of people. But they found out about 3 or 4 years ago that that wasn't the actual first official phone call from the people who had presumably taken Emanuela, that the first phone call came on the night that she disappeared, June 22nd. But the phone call went directly to the press office of the Vatican, and they were looking for the press secretary, Casaroli, who was a cardinal, but he was at the time in Poland with the Pope, so he was not able to speak. But it came between 8 and 9 o'clock when the family really did not know yet what had happened to Emanuela, where there was just speculation, and they were just realizing that she hadn't come home. So it's very interesting that that phone call came to the Vatican at that point, and it mentioned Emanuela, but the family had not yet said anything about her being missing.
So we have a situation now where it's about 12 or 13 days after she's been taken, and all these strange things that don't make sense have happened. The Secret Service, Secret Police come to your house inquiring about her. The Pope makes a statement indicating she's been kidnapped when no one knows that's the case. The Vatican police don't want anything to do with the case because even though she's a Vatican resident, she allegedly went missing outside the walls. What does your family think about all this?
So it was so strange to them. I mean, they really had just fallen into some sort of a nightmare. They really couldn't wrap their heads around what was going on. You know, the Secret Service, they had only ever heard of or seen in movies, and now they were knocking on their front door. So for them, it was just this whole kind of crazy, strange nightmare that was happening. And they always put their trust and their faith, and their point of reference was always the Pope and the cardinals, because that's who they had grown up with. And the Pope coming to their house and saying to them, you know, don't worry, I will find out what happened to Emanuela. I will make sure that, you know, whoever's done this to her is brought to justice. To them was, well, okay, we should have faith in him. We should trust him because that's who we've always looked to. That's who we've always trusted. But at a certain point, he had to decide whether to put first the fate of Emanuela or the image and the reputation of the Catholic Church. And Pietro believes that he chose to maintain the image of the Catholic Church at the unfortunately leave behind the fate of Emanuela. And he believes that Pope John Paul II knows exactly what happened to Emanuela, and so did Pope Benedict, and so does the current Pope as well.
Wow. And that was leading to my next question. At a point in time, you have to go on your own and start digging a little on your own with the information that they have from the phone calls and you know, pieces that they're putting together. At what point do you do that? Just, okay, I need to start doing somewhat of my own investigation here. And what were the results of that?
È difficile raccontare perché sono tanti anni.
It really was, in the beginning, his father was very devout. He was very, you know, committed to the Vatican, and he had faith. He had faith in the Pope. He had faith in the police that they would find Emanuela. So they really took a bit of a step back. And for years, they followed the whole, the story that, you know, she was taken to negotiate the release of Ali Agca, the man who had shot Pope John Paul II, the assassination attempt. So for years, they kind of went with that story. But he said, you know, if a call came in from somebody who said, oh, we saw her in Lucerne, Switzerland, he said, I got on the plane and I went, because he couldn't not follow up on any type of information that was being given to them. He would always think back to that day where she left and he didn't take her to school. And he said, I had to follow through with anything that came up. But it really was when their father died, when Pietro started to kind of take things into his own hands a bit more. He felt that he could speak out a bit more against the Vatican, because that was something his father was very much against. And he had his first, you know, demonstration in front of the Vatican with a bunch of supporters who came out, and the press really criticized him for doing this and for taking these steps, but he felt that this was the right thing to do. And later on, he received, you know, more support. But in the beginning, he was criticized, especially for speaking out against the Vatican. So they believe that the Vatican really used the whole story of Ali Agca, the person who attempted to assassinate Pope John Paul II, to their advantage in this case, because this made them also a victim. So Emanuela was a victim, but so was the Vatican, because this man who tried to assassinate the Pope obviously, you know, went after the Vatican, but then they also went after Emanuela. So for the Vatican, it was a very sort of convenient story for them. And Pietro says that at the time, you know, Pope John Paul II was really put into the papacy to fight communism, really. And he and Reagan were very, very close, and the CIA was constantly in the Vatican. So he says if they were just simple criminals who had taken Emanuela, the CIA could have found out within a matter of days or weeks, really, who it was, because they had all of these resources at their disposal constantly, you know, American CIA and, you know, Italian intelligence and all that. So they kind of really benefited from the fact that people believed that Ali Agca had something to do with this, because the Vatican, they looked like they were the victims as well. So it was Emanuela who was a victim, but also the Vatican, and it didn't implicate them whatsoever. But Pietro said that in 2007, hai ricevuto la lettera di Ali Agca, vero? Ali Agca wrote a letter to Pietro's father in 1997, saying that, you know, he knew what happened. He knew the whole story. And when he was given the opportunity to go back to Turkey to serve the last 10 years of his sentence, so he did. And in 2010, when he was released, Pietro was able to go and see him in Turkey and speak to him. And he said, you know, I know everything. I know that, you know, the cardinals were involved and in the taking of Emanuela, and that they used the Italian, you know, secret service to cover it up and to continue it. And he actually told him to speak to Biden and Pelosi, who Biden at the time was part of the Secret Service. Yes. No. CIA. Sorry. That's what he said. CIA. And he said they're good Catholics and they'll help you find out some information.
So there's, not to digress, but there are other theories that involve the Cosa Nostra and the financial arrangement between the Vatican and the Cosa Nostra, which was to be kept secret. Does he put any stock in, or does he have any belief that there's some link between those two organizations?
Guarda, questa è uscita nel 97, si è chiusa la prima inchiesta, quella legata soprattutto.
So when the first inquiry, the first inquiry that was open against it being sort of a international kidnapping having to do with Ali Agca, when that closed nel 1997, la prima inchiesta del rapimento internazionale, quando si chiude, ok, 97. In 1997, they closed that case. They realized it had nothing to do with Ali Agca. Then this whole theory came forward where there was an anonymous phone call that came to a TV station that if you want to know what happened to Emanuela, you have to dig up the grave of see who was buried in the church of Santa Polinare, which was a church that was very close to the Vatican. And it was also the same building, more or less, where Emanuela's music school was. So they found that that was the grave of the head of this Roman mafia group called the Banda della Magliana. And Enrico De Pedis was the man who was, at the time, the head of this Banda della Magliana. But Pietro believes that, yes, he did have something to do with the kidnapping of Emanuela, but he was really just the manpower behind it. He doesn't think that it could have been organized by him, that it was organized by a greater organization for a greater purpose. Because if it would have just been a mafia, the mafia involvement, again, the people in the Vatican and the Secret Service would have found out what was going on, and they would have been able to maybe stop it in a sense. So there was some bigger force at hand, for sure. So the whole issue with the Vatican Bank and the money that was coming from the mafia that was being brought to the Vatican Bank was really to fund the whole efforts to get rid of communism. The Solidarność group, who Pope John Paul supported very much in Poland. And so that was the whole question of the mafia gave the Vatican money and they were looking for their money back, and the Vatican did not have their money, so that Emanuela was taken for, you know, to blackmail the Vatican. But, you know, Pietro and the family really believe that there has to be something bigger than that, because just kidnapping of a young girl like that was not enough blackmail, really. And even though the stories have come out that Pope John Paul did take money from the mafia, there really was no solid proof. But they say for the Vatican to keep this a secret for 40 years, there really has to be something bigger that she holds that, could really just completely demolish the whole image of the Vatican.
Wow. I mean, to put that much on a young 15-year-old girl, you know, to have her involved in such a grand scheme as what it seems, leading back to the Vatican, must be an enormous amount of heartache and pressure on a family who deeply believes in the Vatican and kind of took their word at what would be going on afterwards. That must be a tremendous ontake to put your faith in that and then have it turn on you. So through the years and the investigation going on, well, his investigation going on and the numerous leads that he has developed and theories that he's come up with, in January, I believe in 2023, the investigation actually somewhat got reopened. Can he take us through that and what that means and what's going on right now, the communications that he's had with that investigation?
È stata aperta la seconda inchiesta nel 2006, dopo la famosa telefonata.
So in 2015, they kind of archived the whole, all the inquiries, the case that they had opened up with De Pedis. So they kind of came to that was sort of a dead end conclusion. So right before the De Pedis case was closed, there was a new head of the magistrate of the police in Rome, this gentleman named Pignatore. And he seemed to be on the side of the Vatican. He assured them that everything would be taken care of. And sure enough, he archived the whole De Pedis case. And he said, you know, there was a conversation between De Pedis' wife and the cardinal who was in charge of the church at Santa Polinare, where De Pedis was found, where his grave was found. And she said, don't worry, now we have the lead investigator, the head of the police that we want on our side. So this gentleman Pignatore, he was going to archive everything. And then, of course, he was taken and he was promoted to work at the Vatican. So that just goes to show you how they like to sort of keep their people close to them. So at this moment, he is the president of the Tribunal of the Vatican. Non so come si traduce tribunale, the tribunal. He's the head of the, basically, the Supreme Court justice of the Vatican. So the head of the Vatican courthouse.
Over the years, there have been so many theories and so many different things that have happened with regards to this case. What do you think is the answer? And do you have an opinion, a theory as to what happened to Emanuela that day?
Allora, c'è stato sicuramente un ricattato e un ricattatore, quello è sicuro.
So basically, he knows that there was, she was kidnapped and there was a kidnapper, right? We know that. We know she was taken and she didn't go of her own free will. And, you know, he's very certain that the Vatican has something to do with it, and that, you know, the mafia involvement was really just sort of like the manpower, the ones who were acting at the requests of the mafia, of the Vatican. But there right now are three open investigations, open inquiries. One that has been opened by Pope Francis, the other one that has been opened by the district attorney's office in Rome, and another one that's been opened by the National Italian Police. And he's right now been following the trail. He calls it the London Trail. So there were papers found in a locked box in the Vatican that talk about how the citizen Emanuela Orlandi was taken and kept in London, and it was spoken about a bit in the Netflix documentary. And why she was taken there, he's not really sure, but he keeps following that trail, and he feels that that would lead him somewhere. But he keeps reaching out to the district attorney's office in Rome to try to help with this London trail that he's been following, and nobody ever gets back to him. So he's kind of been on his own, and he's got a couple of other pieces of information that he's also going to share with us now. So from the beginning, they couldn't believe the involvement from so many other outside agencies. So for example, like German intelligence was involved, Russian intelligence was involved, American intelligence was involved. And so they ask themselves, you know, when you have involvement from all these other intelligence agencies from around the world, this has to be something big. So he obviously still believes that she was taken and by the De Pedis, by the Banda della Magliana, and with the testimony of De Pedis' girlfriend, Sabrina Minardi, that she was kept in Italy for a few months. And then she was then turned over back to the Vatican, as Minardi testified. She said in the Netflix documentary that she handed her over to a car with Vatican plates. And so that's when Pietro believes that she was given back to the Vatican, and them not knowing what to do with her. They couldn't return her to her family because she knew too much about something. And they had to keep her somewhere. So that's why he believes that he has paperwork that states that she was kept at this home in London that was indeed, you know, under the care of the Vatican. And that's when you also involve, you know, British intelligence and British law enforcement and the British, you know, government, essentially. And so it just became this big thing. And it was no longer just this citizen of the Vatican who was taken on Italian soil, but now you're, again, involving all of these other intelligence agencies. And he said, when those papers were found in a locked box in the Vatican that were very specific about where she was taken in London and how it was paid for and all that, and it was financed, he said the Vatican came out right away and said, nope, those are fake. Those are fake. They are absolutely not correct. That is not correct. And they dismissed it right away. And he said that has something, you know, that obviously holds weight, that they didn't want that to come out.
I was going to say, I remember at one point was it Pope Benedict visited your house? Is that correct?
Pope John Paul. So 6 months after, yeah, 6 months after Emanuela disappeared, 3 days before Ali Akça went to prison.
So what I was going to ask, you know, you have the papers found in the Vatican, and then the Vatican comes out and says that's all fake. Well, how would they know that? You know, how do you come out with documents and stuff that were found and then profess it's not fake if you don't know what's going on, or you don't know an outcome, or you don't know where she is? How would you know those are all fake? I mean, that's the first thing that comes to mind. And has Scotland Yard in London been involved in this at all?
You know, him as a citizen, it's hard for him on his level to be able to really get in touch with anybody, at certain points. So he actually has letters between a cardinal and an English politician about where Emanuela was being kept in London. And he keeps telling the, you know, Scotland Yard or the British, you know, district attorney, the officials, that he has these letters. And he knows the name of this secretary, this politician, and nobody ever gets in touch with him. Nobody ever calls him back. And he says, I have this information, I have this proof, and nobody ever wants to get in touch with me. So he says, me as a citizen, it's so hard for me to, you know, I can only get so far a lot of times if nobody gets in touch with me, or nobody gives me a platform. So they're convinced, he's convinced that there are CIA documents from the time that state what happened to Emanuela. He said it's impossible that there were not, because he said Reagan was very, very close to Pope John Paul. And he said the CIA was practically at home in the Vatican. And he said there's so many, you know, indications that they would know what was going on, and that were definitely, there was documentation. I mean, he believes that not only do many people in the Vatican and in Italy know what happened, he says there are people around the world that definitely know the truth and what happened, that are all keeping it secret. And there's certainly documentation on it. It's just impossible to get.
So has the Netflix series and just social media in general been helpful to him in his efforts?
So yeah, the Netflix documentary opened doors, and it's been seen in over 160 countries. So it really brought attention more to the younger generation, you know, the generation that wasn't really around when Emanuela disappeared. So he's received so many messages from around the world of solidarity and support. And it did kind of push the Vatican, with all the media coverage, to reopen this inquiry and the investigation. But it's really under false pretenses. It's basically just a farce. They're doing it sort of to appease the public, really. And, you know, Pietro says he has not received at all in these 40 years any sign of, you know, comfort or solidarity or support from the Vatican whatsoever. And he's felt that they've lacked complete understanding, complete, you know, they haven't been, in essence, good Christians. They haven't really reached out to him and his family. And in this new investigation, this new inquiry, they're really trying to point the finger more at the family and blame them and their involvement in the whole thing, and trying to find sort of a conclusion that is comfortable for them, and doesn't really point the finger at Vatican having the involvement here. And so it's really just a kind of a big farce, in his opinion.
Wow. Well, that's sad. I mean, the circumstances around everything is sad. And we will certainly do our part as much as we can to keep Manuela's memory alive, her name alive, anything we can do to push the information. And we can't thank Pietro enough for being here with us and lending us, you know, an inside look into this investigation and circumstances. That is sad. It's infuriating. as two men of faith, you know, that he's talking to, and you as well, Maria. It's sad, but we are in his corner and we'll do anything we can to help him out.
È come se non fossero passati 40 anni.
It doesn't feel like 40 years have gone by because of, you know, everything he's been doing to just keep her name out there and keep her memory alive and to just continue to fight. He said, I will always fight for injustices, for this injustice that has been done, and I will continue to fight. He only realizes that it's been 40 years when he goes to speak at colleges and he sees these young people who were born 20 years after she was taken. And that's when he realizes that it's been that long, but it doesn't feel like it's been that long because he's been constantly fighting for his sister and to, you know, get answers and to really just make sure that these injustices don't go unpunished in a way. And he'll never stop fighting for that, for the injustice.
So on June 22nd, 1983, 15-year-old Emanuela Orlandi left home to go to music school, was never seen again. Everyone's lives have been changed, your life, your family's, everyone's. But you have never given up. You are an example of what family love is, and your dedication and commitment are remarkable, and we would do anything that we could do to help you. And we will continue to pray for you and your family as you go through this very long, endless nightmare.
Yeah, he said, until I see a bone, a body, he said, for me, I will never rest. I will not rest until I find some proof, something of her. And he said, we'll get there. He says, I see the glass half full. So he's optimistic that he will still receive answers. He's an incredible optimist. It's just sort of ingrained in their entire family to just continue this search and this battle. And he said, no injustice, big or small, should ever go ignored. And you should never stop fighting. His son, Robin, who's 22 years old, said, if you die one day, can I continue to look for Zia, for my aunt? And, you know, of course, he said, of course you can. So he's never even met her, but it's just ingrained in him and his family to continue this fight.
Well, God bless them all, for sure. And please, Pietro, keep us updated with any new developments, anything you need, anything that we can do for you. We have a platform to get information out, you know, through social media platforms we have and our show. And please, either through Maria or us directly, let us know anything we can do and update so we can do another show on this and keep Emanuela on everyone's mind.
Grazie.
But he said this type of solidarity really, it fills him up. It recharges his battery, so to speak, that it gives him the strength to continue to go on. So just seeing this solidarity and the support from all people from around the world is something that really gives him the will to keep the fight going.
We thank you, Pietro. We can never thank you enough for giving us your time, sharing your story. Maria, for your excellent, molto grazie. Maria, for your excellent translation services and your assistance today. My partner, Tom Smith, we know we will see you again, Pietro. We want to talk with you again. We want to stay in touch with you. And we will talk after we wrap. But thank you again so much for your time and for Gold Shields. I'm Dan Murphy, along with my partner, Tom Smith. Everyone, stay safe.
Thank you.